I'm doing quite well right now, thanks, Scott. It was evidently a big slip. I don't know. I don't recall any of it. So that's one of the first indicators that it was a pretty big problem, is that I lost about a half hour of my life there, at least to my memory. But yeah, I had a severe concussion and some bleeding on the brain that lasted a couple of days, and had a seizure. Although I don't remember any of that. But the neurosurgeons, that there were three of them that looked at the CT scan, that are pretty convinced that I had, and based on other, things. All that to say that on Friday they did a CT scan, and as I like to say, it came back negative of the brain. But what it means is that it's actually, the way it's reported is that the issue is resolved. So the brain's not bleeding, which is mainly the main thing. So I feel pretty much normal right now and feel grateful about all of that.
Wow. Yeah. Very scary though. And a good reminder for everybody.
Yes.
There's one bad thing when a U.S. senator falls and ends up with a severe concussion like that, as the world knows about it. But that's the good thing too, because we can all be a little more careful.
Well, that's right, Scott. And I've, as you know, whenever I've had a tragedy, I always, I try to be as transparent about it as possible, because there's no secret. There are no secrets. And I, just like you just said, I think there's opportunity, to remind people that, hang, as Rick Scott keeps telling me, hold on to the handrails. Our friend Rick Scott from Florida, who used to own a large healthcare system, he told me the other day, I was coming up some steps without holding the handrail, and he said, I'm gonna be the biggest pain in your ass of anybody, just so you know. So every couple times a day, he reminds me of certain things I need to be doing to make sure I don't ever fall again and hit my head.
My wife said after that happened, sent it out the wide text to the family
Yeah.
that remember, we're all only one fall away from the nursing home. So at any
Yeah,
time, no
that's
matter what
right.
age you are, it is certainly, and with our weather, something to be careful for. Speaking of
Well,
hanging on to the handrails, a lot has happened since we talked last and continues to
no
happen.
kidding.
Every day is a year in the Trump administration. Lots to cover. Let's get an update first on the tariffs. I know that you've had a lot
Yeah.
of, you're being called on for lots of counsel in Canada. Interestingly enough, one of my favorite stories that you told us was that, the Canadian business leaders, they're even okay with this 51st state thing. So a few of them are glad that this disruption is happening, but obviously there's a fair amount of hand-wringing too. What's the latest?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, well, the Canadian one has been the most interesting to me because, first of all, we have a lot of firsthand knowledge as a northern tier state, and a strong relationship with Canada, and the provinces that we border. The University of North Dakota is blessed every year by great Canadian hockey players, and a lot of our products go back and forth, including, by the way, oil and gas especially. And so, the Canadian one's been the most fluid, but I think the president landed on a really good spot last week when, remember, going back a month, he announced 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, and then he gave Canada a pause because they had demonstrated some real movement toward stopping the flow of fentanyl into the United States. After 30 days of that, there was still some evidence that they hadn't done enough. He put the tariffs back on, but then with the help of Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce, who's of one mind with Donald Trump on the role of tariffs, realized that while we do have this U.S.-Canada-Mexico agreement, Mexico agreement, a trade deal that Donald Trump himself negotiated, what they did is they lifted the sanctions on any of the products where either of the countries are complying with USMCA rules. And I think that's logical. That's fair trade. That's what we negotiated. Now, there will be some things where it's not. And, dairy being one of those things where, we're still not at a level playing field. And so I think that on that one, in fact, without revealing too many details or too many people, a Canadian leader just last week, said to me that that they thought maybe this needed to happen, that this was a wake-up call for the continent, for their government, as well as our international businesses. And so, like Donald Trump so oftentimes does, he'll announce something The mainstream media, especially, his hair is on fire. And then, of course, stakeholder groups, associations, and whatnot sort of panic. And then within days, it all works itself out. And he's masterful, as you know, Scott, at negotiating things in public when necessary.
And, you know, we've seen this movie before. It did not cause the disruption that many predicted it would in the first term. He's certainly telegraphed that he was going to do it this time. My question is, he in an interview this weekend said something about maybe it will be a recession. A recession, I don't know. In his State of the Union, he sort of said, hey, there'll be some pain here. In my question to anybody whose life is being disrupted as a result of this or uncertainty comes, how much is an American life worth? I mean, if we're talking about getting tough on China so they don't make the stuff and manufacture the chemicals, and we're getting tough on Canada and Mexico so we don't just allow the flow in that literally is killing people, you know, can't we be okay with some cost for that?
I would say the death of 100,000 people a year by this poisoning is worth whatever price in many respects. And when I pray. Let's forget, Scott, that what Donald Trump is, many presidents prior to him weren't willing to do. And that's why everything seems so much more dramatic, because the debt is $36 trillion, as one example, as we talk about, you know, getting our financial house in order when it comes to reciprocal trade and trade barriers in other countries and our unequal treatment of the United States. And when we're the biggest consuming nation in the world, everybody should want our business, not take advantage of our business. And so, yeah, sometimes it looks like it's a dramatic fix on his part, but that's because of the pent up demand for some change. And let's face it, Donald Trump, not only did he win the popular vote and the Electoral College, but he's a one-term president, and he knows that, and the American people know that, and I think we're getting exactly what most people signed up for. Granted, along the way there'll be some hurt. And I don't think most people are surprised by it, and I think by and large people are willing to give him that leeway and that room to try some of the stuff out that he ran on.
Let's talk about the Democrats and their performance during Trump's speech. What was that all about, anyway?
Well, first of all, I wasn't surprised, unfortunately, by the Democrats' reaction. Although in real time, as I was watching it, when Donald Trump got to the point in the speech, which is a tradition, as you know, with him, and it started a couple of presidents back, but of highlighting real live Americans that are either suffering the consequences or enjoying the fruits and the benefits of a new order of things. We've always been bipartisan in our applause and for our country, it's a celebratory moment. And when they went so far as to literally, certainly by the next day, they'd be regretting it. And I think some of them are, and certainly several of the pundits were. And when they saw the polling numbers, depending on which liberal network you were watching, they basically went from somewhere around 70% to 80% approval by the American public. And then they came out, of course, with that bizarro, cringy, superwoman video thing that, I don't even know how to describe it, so stupid. And they followed up their stupidity on Tuesday night with more stupidity on Thursday. And it's as though they are hopeless. It's as though they have no barometer, no compass, no political consultant with a brain.
Yeah, really a bizarre. Also, last week we saw them vote in lockstep on the question of protecting girls' sports. Are there not Democrats that realize how offensive that is? Like, well, it played out in the Senate, similar vote in Minnesota. What's going on here?
I think there are several. I think there are a lot of them that grieve it, actually. The problem they have now is, as a party, if they don't stick together 100% on an issue, then they fray, and then pretty soon they unravel very, very fast. And so I think they've made, or when I say they, I think Chuck Schumer, by and large, has made a calculated decision that we have to keep the whole team together, otherwise we lose our own credibility, as though they have any. and so there is, and which I sort of understand from a purely a strategic or even a tactical standpoint. The problem is, it gets back to the similar behavior at the speech. They're gonna regret this much sooner than they think. And again, I think they already are, because you see polling. This is an issue that's like 79% that the American people are for this specific bill that a number of us sponsored. Tommy Tuberville led the charge, of course, former Auburn coach and now United States Senator that understands Title IX very well. And what this bill does, it's Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act. It requires any institution that receives Title IX support, which is all of them, to protect women in sports. And if they don't, then their federal funding will be withheld. And I think what it comes down to at that point, Scott, is their love, theirs being the Democrats, their left's love for the institutions of government supersedes their respect for the people that they're supposed to be representing. There's that. And then there is their wacky, very wacky, weirdo, Star Wars bar scene, base that they just are afraid to offend, as though they're going to make the difference in the next election. And it looks like almost a death wish for the Democratic Party. I got to believe that at some point somebody's going to resist. John Fetterman or somebody will say, you know what, I'm not going this far, you nut jobs. So let's get with it. But for now, they seem to be anchored to positions.
There's a couple of storms coming related to government funding and the budget reconciliation and the Trump agenda arguments play out. There seems to be some traction among the Democrats lampooning Republican budget proposals over Medicaid. I'm curious. We talked to some House Republicans who say it's literally not in the bill. I've seen others say on the Republican side, well, we're going to have to change that a little bit on the Senate side because that's going to make some of our Republicans vulnerable. What's the real story on that funding?
Well, I think all of those things can be true. To be very clear, though, there is no reference to Medicaid in either of the budgets, either the House budget nor the Senate budget. And what I'm talking about now are those resolutions that will eventually be reconciled into one big beautiful bill, I guess, and ultimately hopefully pass that makes the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act permanent law, and then some other tax and spending provisions. So there's nothing in either one of those bills that puts Medicaid at risk. But what does happen is the resolutions themselves really don't get very specific. They provide a top line, how much money you need to spend, how much money you need to save. It gives particular a reference to specific committees and agencies where you need to find the savings.
So all this is just Washingtonese of saying, well, if you're reducing the budget, then of course you're going to take it from Medicaid. Assuming all
well,
that then.
Yeah, it does. And realizing that when it comes to any significant cuts to the budget and reconciliation has to come from mandatory spending. So discretionary spending is not on the block there in terms of savings. So Medicaid, of course, is one of the bigger mandatory programs, but so is Medicare, so is Social Security, so is SNAP. There are lots of mandatory spending that's not Medicaid. And what I always say about Medicaid in particular is you don't have to cut benefits to find savings in Medicaid if you get rid of fraud, waste, and abuse. And frankly, what I think the ultimate solution is block grant Medicaid right to the states and let each state make up their own mind about who is served by Medicaid, what the parameters are, what kind of reimbursements you need for doctors and healthcare facilities. And when you consider North Dakota with its 36 rural hospitals or critical access hospitals, along with a few major ones, that's a different population and a different base of healthcare than, say, New York or California.
And if New York and California 100%. Want no work requirements, they don't care. They want to hand out entitlements with them. Fine, they're going to get X amount of dollars, and they can plus it up and rich
and
it up themselves.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying, Scott. And that's a good way to put it. And by the way, I think under any scenario like that, and I would say the same thing, by the way, for education. Any scenario like that, North Dakota is always going to come out better. We just always do. And I remember last go around when we had the solution that the repeal replace Obamacare that John McCain tragically flushed in the Senate after we passed it in the House. That was probably the best part of that whole bill was the block granting of Medicaid to states, which would have provided, even if it was the same amount of money as the, say, the year before, you would have gotten a lot more bang for that dollar. Plus, remember this, you take away the middleman. When you take away the huge federal bureaucracy between the collection of taxes and then the distribution of them through agencies, you're going to save large percentage of that money, and right there, just by not letting it go run through the fingers of another agency or two.
Just a couple minutes left here, but I want to ask you about two more things. One related to the whole government funding, and you're, once again, we're at the precipice, right? So how's this going to play out?
Yeah, so as you probably saw over the weekend, the House posted their bill for a continuing resolution. And just to remind people what continuing resolution, or CR, is in our parlance, is that's continuing spending at the current levels with all the current laws in place. And I hate CRs. Most conservatives hate CRs because it means that you're operating under the previous year's budget. And in this case, that would have been Joe Biden's budget. So we've been operating under this short-term CR until next Friday, at which point government funding runs out. But we're also halfway through the year. And so the fiscal year ends September 30th. The House came up with a bill that has a CR to the end of the year, but it does provide some what are called anomalies, Scott. And why that's important is one of the things about CRs, remember I said they operate under the same policies as the previous budget, which means in the Defense Department, for example, you know, our military men and women don't get a raise. That can't be part of it. It also means that they can't have new starts. So if there's a weapons systems or munitions, new munitions program that was gauged or prepared, and we, in some cases, that we've even passed in policy in the National Defense Authorization Act, that a CR doesn't allow them to do that. So we do have some, I say we, the House, in the House's bill, has some anomalies like that, including a plus up for defense spending. It's modest. It's like $7 billion, but that's not nothing. And in a time like this, they need everything they can get. So, and then it does do a waiver on the no new starts. So Pete Hegseth, for example, can look at an old, you know, legacy system that somebody's been maintaining someplace and say, no, we need to replace that with a new satellite program, or the, you know, there's any number of systems that are ready to get started. So with all of that, Donald Trump strongly supports it. The House Freedom Caucus strongly supports it. Some of our Republicans in the Senate actually support it. I mean, we have senators that have never voted for a continuing resolution. I tend to not to vote for them, except on a very short-term basis. But once we see the text, and it is out now this weekend, my team's going over it. Tuesday, it sounds like the House is going to vote on it. It sounds like they have the votes to pass it. The biggest challenge, Scott, in the Senate is this, and that is if Democrats do to this government funding bill what they did to Tommy Tuberville's Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act, and that is hold together and kill it, we can't pass it. We need 60 votes in the Senate to pass funding. So, but then on top of that, remember, again, we have this budget reconciliation process where the resolutions need to be reconciled, and then we're going to really go to town. I would add one other thing, and that is, you know, we had a very good meeting with Senate Republicans and Elon Musk the other day. He came to our lunch on Wednesday, and a lot of us talked to him pretty regularly in his Doge program, and he, you know, we're going through a number of the potential savings there. The president can make a rescission request. In fact, he can make all the rescission requests he wants about rescinding money that has been appropriated in the previous Congress and even in the law. And we can pass on a simple vote, a simple majority vote in the Senate and the House the same, of course, and provide them, we can take those dollars back, put them back into other funding, other priorities, or just, you know, pay down the debt.
I've seen around the country these pop-up protests that are happening. So how about you? Are you seeing any organized protest at all?
Well, if there is any, it is organized. That's the only kind that really is. There certainly hasn't been a lot of what I'd call organic opposition, but there have been some panic and some people are worried, and there have been some protests. I don't think any of them at the offices, but I don't know. I've got five offices in North Dakota, and I haven't been to any of the ones outside of Bismarck in the last few weeks. But But they've been holding some protests. Every now and then, I'll see a picture in a blog or something, or a Facebook page, or see some news, or get a call from a reporter, and it seems like there's, you know, I saw in one picture, it's the headline. One of the TV stations, not a far away, the headline was protesters come out in mass, and they had a picture of eight people, and I'm thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I think I forgot the biggest one I've counted in North Dakota is like 11 people. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
exactly. You know, and but it does seem somewhat organized. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not against stakeholder groups organizing, you know, to for political activism. I'd rather enjoy that, as a matter of fact. But I have noticed that throughout the country, there's a similar type style, so to say, on a lot of their stuff. And that does diminish some of the, you know, some of the sensitivity of it all, in my view.
But you've been in politics a long time. Do you sense any real opposition out there to this? I mean, any, you know, obviously you're going to have various constituencies and associations. They're mm-hmm. going to, hey, we're a little worried about this, a little worried about that. But I mean, given the level of change that has come with the American people since January 20th, you'd think there'd be an earthquake of political opposition. I mean, compare this. It seems pretty feckless, doesn't it?
Oh, pretty feckless indeed. I mean, I did two or three radio shows last week in the few moments I had that were spared. But and I didn't get a single call about it. I've been around a lot. I've been at 2 days full of dancing, you know, dancing competitions, volleyball games, and soccer matches. Throughout Bismarck Mandan, and not a single person, and I've seen hundreds of them, has raised this issue as a concern. Now, I've had lots of people say, we love what Trump's doing, we love Elon Musk, tell him to keep it up, and I've had lots of that. But, you know, some people have gotten a little nervous about the VA, for example. I know there's an announcement of some layoffs, or some people had to be, removed that were on probation, you know, that whole probationary employee thing. But none of them were healthcare providers. And I think that's a pretty good sign that Donald Trump and my friend Doug Collins, who's now the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, they're serious about helping the veteran and less concerned about the bureaucracy.
In fact, are saying whatever savings we do find is going to go into additional care for veterans, right?
And that's something that we've been all about since the day I got on the VA committee and well before that. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
I'm glad it worked out. Sorry that Friday didn't work out. Hopefully, you know, our Fridays are very different these days, Scott, now that John Thune keeps us there to get people confirmed. As you know, we've been on a breakneck pace to get Donald Trump his confirmations for his cabinet secretaries, and now we're at the undersecretary and assistant secretary and deputy secretary level, and going to try to punch those out as best we can. And this week we'll be busy doing that, as well as hopefully getting the government funded before the end of the week, and then we can go on to other bigger and better things.
Say, if you want to bring Elon Musk out to North Dakota, we'd be okay with that.
Would you be okay with that?
I
maybe could lure him out there. You know, they've been after me for a long time to get him up to UND and take
Let's
a look
go.
At the aerospace school and meet with the faculty and whatnot. And let's just say Elon and I are getting to understand each other better every day. So maybe I can get him up to North Dakota. But I don't want to take him away from the important work he's doing either, because as you know, we're really overpaying him for that. But I think his salary is the same as Donald Trump's is for being president, which I'm pretty sure is nothing.
Unbelievable. That's a whole other show, as we say.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah. Thanks, Scotty. Bye-bye.